on Through the Leaves and Theatre is a discussion that I had with the playwright Bob Dean. Bob Dean is the editor and publisher of The Perfect Pitch, as well as the playwright. He is a studied man, protege of sorts, of Marshall McLuhan and James Joyce, and he has some very interesting thoughts on theater, the electronic media, and the cosmic village. And good morning for Critical Culture. My name is Dennis Armstrong. This morning with guest Mr. Bob Dean, who is the publisher and editor of The Perfect Pitch, as well as the playwright. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Dennis.
You have some particular thoughts on media, the electronic media and television, and its effect on theater in particular, for this morning anyway, but and in culture in general, that the electronic media certainly molds audience expectations and actively, I guess, changes the roles of thespians, of actors, of directors, of playwrights. How does that do that?
Well, I think that Marshall McLuhan's views on media, and by media he meant any man-made environment, any man-made artifact from language to bulldozers through television and computers, I think that Western man's bias has been conceptual, and Marshall emphasized the perceptual bias that's created through any technology, and he got this through the study of rhetoric at Cambridge. Rhetoric was a study of the nonverbal effects of language, the effects of gesture and those, and rhythm and cadence, mm-hmm. as well as the content and meaning per se of the words imparted. He applied this to modern languages, which by that he meant the technologies and the ensuing environments they created. He called this a medium. For example, one television has no effect on a population, but once the majority of the population is using it, then it has a rather corporate effect. And he found it surprising that the critics and commentators on culture and the state of the arts and society in general would ignore the rhetorical and inevitable effect of television on the events of the 50s and 60s and 70s, which he was commenting on. So in theater in particular, obviously the sensibilities of the audience would be changed by television, regardless of what was on television. The electronic effect, the what he called tactile effect of television, would create preferences in the audience and create a different kind of audience, which would have to be mirrored or echoed by the theater companies. And the particular thing we were discussing was when they use people from, say, the recording industry to perform in theater, mm-hmm. why is this accepted unquestioningly when the person obviously hasn't been trained in the craft of acting? And those who require that skill in their actors as they're watching them might be upset about this, but they're missing the fact that their private preference is being swamped in the larger effect of television on the audiences, and that the mixed media effect on television would allow audiences not to be particularly concerned about a specialist discipline of acting.
This is, again, a reference to The Tooth of Crime.
Yes.
Yeah. Why is it that one medium like television cannot transmute or transpose, or theater cannot metamorph itself into suit television? Or why is television overwhelming things like acting and theater?
Because I think it as an environment, it's something we use daily, including other electronic technology, the telephone and computer. These have effects on all parts of society, but in theater in particular, it's not going to escape the changing of the nature of the audience.
Yeah, but certainly a lot of the aspects, a lot of the disciplines in theater are things that we use every day or are exposed to every day.
In what sense? Do you mean what disciplines? Do you mean in advertising?
Well, no, not in advertising. I was thinking more in terms of in the history of man, theater has always been the number one form for public communication. In the last 30 years, television has supplanted that theater as the forum for human communication en masse. But there's certainly, I have a feeling that there must be residual effects, a traditional sort of feeling for theater.
Oh, yes, now that's true. Now, Marshall would say that television wouldn't obliterate theater, but it would cause changes in it, and also would create a nostalgia for certain levels of the audience, those who are more used to the older forms of theater, and they would become more rigid in their preference, and maybe would bring back older forms of theater as a form of preserving their old sensory biases, which were conditioned under earlier technologies. It's kind of like freezing on the controls. In other words, the older forms of culture will continue, and they would be...
Oh, I see. If you're talking in terms of sensory loads and capacities, theater, your first exposure to theater, I guess as it is to opera or to any of the wonders of the world, you're saying it actually has a physiological effect on you. The bright lights, the music, the hugeness is a huge sensory experience.
Well, one thing...
And television is even bigger.
Oh, yeah, as an environment... People only go to theater maybe once a month.
Because it's pale in comparison to television.
Yeah, to the general sensory effect of television, which is constant in our lives.
Is that because television is fundamentally just sensory perception and the content of that program is almost irrelevant?
No. Marshall would point out the content plays a role, but the larger effect was the rhetorical effect, the sensory effect of television itself, the cathode ray tube shooting at the viewer. And he said the viewer became the screen, where it was not a light being reflected off something like the book page or the movie screen.
Mm-hmm.
So this creates a very visceral, tactile merging with the TV screen, which then would be reflected in fashions and in other areas of culture, which would express that need, that sensory fact that's happened. And, for example, the sudden rise in drug-taking among young people in the 60s mm-hmm. was an empathetic response and reflex to the merging impact of television, the merging with the screen.
Hmm.
So there's one, that's the rise of drug taking, and then it's accelerated many times since then, so that the pace of life, I think, makes drug taking almost automatic.
Necessity?
Yeah.
Where does this leave, not to be cute or anything, but the case is, the catchphrase, the medium is the message, is very true then, isn't it?
Yes, Innes explained this as a scholar, though a lot of people missed the message, but Marshall applied it to the new environment that was around him. Innes sort of brought it up to radio. The medium is the message means that the effect of the environment is a lot more consequential to the Western man because he tends to focus on content and misses the rhetorical effect.
Hmm.
So therefore, those who are dissatisfied with the state of the theater today or the kinds of plays they're put on, it's okay if they're dissatisfied, if they have a certain sensory preference. But if they're not understanding that the ground is changing, the technological ground, and is making people have different preferences that weren't applied or thought of
mm-hmm.
30, 40 years ago, then that if they miss that point, they're missing an ability to understand why the audience seems to be however they perceive they are.
Arthur Miller, you said, wrote a book on how television would ensure the death of Broadway.
Yes,
in 1949.
Yeah, he wrote an essay in some American periodical.
What is your feeling as a playwright about the future of theater?
Well, I think that I consider Marshall's point that Sputnik made and the subsequent satellite environment made the whole planet a theater. So therefore, if the theater environment, theater effect has moved to a global level, what's the role of the institution of theater? I think the strategy would be to consider the rhetorical effect and somehow bring this into the medium of theater, but it would not just be mixed media or the way the happenings attempted to do it, to sort of point out the other influences of technologies. I think there's a more interesting strategy, which I think is being done by politicians and intelligence agencies around the world, and that the traditional artists have been usurped by those who have handles the power and can get right in there and use it. So this is a problem that...
Is it no accident that Ronald Reagan, an ex-actor, is the president of the United States and one of the, again, leading actors in the international forum?
That's not an accident. Marshall predicted in the 60s that Hollywood would become a classroom and a preparation for future politicians. And then in 1975, right when it looked like Ronald Reagan's career was in decline, he predicted that if you want to look to the man of the future, it'll be Ronald Reagan, because he had the ability to merge with his bureaucratic role, and the actor is trained in that way. So he was ahead of everybody on that one with Ronald Reagan. He predicted it in 75, five years before he surfaced as a real political contender.
Anyway, all the world's a stage. We're all just mere players. That's even more true now than ever before, isn't it?
Well, now all the stage is a world.
Yes.
It's reversed.
Yes. Anyway, I'd like to thank you, Bob, for dropping by.
Okay.
Okay, Bob Dean, playwright, editor, and publisher of The Perfect Pitch. I'm Dennis Armstrong for Critical Culture. CKLN, that was playwright Bob Dean, also the publisher and editor of The Perfect Pitch, and who will be a bi-weekly, I hope, contributor to Critical Culture. Again, I would like to extend the invitation to our listening audience to submit any letters or comments, criticisms, or if you have an opinion, that maybe something can be arranged that CKLN, your community station, could voice your views too. And the theaters and the galleries too should not shy away from walking down Yonge Street. And having been an observer of the human zoo for most of my 28 years now, and also having studied psychoanalysis and things like that in various institutions, I have this problem right now. I'm at a crisis point, to say, with Freud's hierarchy of needs and the actualization of the ego. If in fact, we're born with an ego, or if it's something that is a derivative of the dichotomy between the id and the superego. I think the ego is most blatantly obvious through art. Okay, and ergo the old saying, if I can make a loose connection, only artists suffer because of that conflict. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think you'd have to distinguish between the ego and private consciousness. All human beings through all time had private consciousness. However, I think the ego...
Sorry, what's a private consciousness?
That sort of, not a void, but that sort of feeling that you're conscious of whatever's going on. Whatever situation that happens, there's always that feeling of being detached from it, or that I'm experiencing this. The knower. Let's call it the knower.
Okay, and how can you distinguish that from the concept of ego?
Okay, this is what I'll do. Ego, before literacy, was not prominent in tribal societies. The ego got really amplified under the effect of the Gutenberg environment, the printing press. That is when the role of the artist got hoiked out of the society, whereas in tribal societies, art was doing anything as well as you could. There was no particular personality identified with it. It was a communal process. Art as a commodity, as a package, which is the distinctive nature of Western art, especially since the Renaissance and the Gutenberg environment, is an amplification of the individual ego. Now, I'd say that your feeling that there's no ego today, which you haven't expressed, but we're leading into that, as you've indicated before.
Yes.
The electric environment swamps the ego so much, the private identity, the private ego that comes out of literacy, that people are no longer inclined to an active, willful interaction with the environment. It's more a passive relationship with the environment, basically because the electric environment diffuses the individual identity into a corporate syndrome of mass man, which is having access to any part of the planet any time, 24 hours a day.
Okay, and that's fairly obvious on a sociological face of anyone can walk down Yonge Street, and if you look for it, you can see tribes of people, literally, tribes of heavy metal and punksters and businessmen on Bay Street who pretty well look the same, have the same ideas in that, and you begin to wonder what separates one from another. It's almost, you mentioned the age of Gutenberg, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and I have this feeling right now that we're living in the age of illusion.
Fantasy.
Fantasy, illusion, yeah.
In the 20s and 30s, the movie environment gave us dreams that money could buy. But television, which is more post-industrial, more post-consumer, because the images on television are better than anything you can buy in an A&P.
Yeah.
So that we're living in a image consumption, content consumption of the media, and this creates total fantasy.
poor Joan Collins. For 30, 40 years, she tried to make it as a movie star and as a stage actress, as a thespian. It wasn't until Dynasty came up that this haggard, almost has-been, discovered this whole new life, literally. It gave her life. But does this mean that art, per se, in the loose sense of the word, is our ultimate destruction, or is it our ultimate haven for salvation?
Well, again, the art as a consumer commodity is daily business today. The function of the artist has always been to train perception on the immediate present, the actual environment that was molding our attitudes and ideas, and our preferences for certain kinds of art trends.
Okay, where does that leave the artist then, the creative process?
The creative process, he merges with the society like a tribal society. So
yeah, but that's servicing then, isn't it?
Yes.
Like, I'm not talking about an artisan who designs things for popular consumption. I'm talking about creating visions.
We need a new strategy, because obviously the artist, any skill today, is used in the corporate process through advertising or any form of entertainment, is teamwork, corporate teamwork. The private individual ego that's identified with a Da Vinci or the traditional Western ideal of a man who stands aside and criticizes the culture, the basic assumptions. We need a new strategy. And that strategy requires the recognition of the media environments themselves are art forms in the sense they train our perception. So how can we get a perspective on an operation where we're being not brainwashed, but our whole sensory thresholds, all our sensory levels are being organized in the way that artists did it for people 100 and 200 years ago. They train people's perception, but not today. Those arts don't.
Where is that artistic antagonism going to come from? Where is the ego going to be in the next century?
The ego will be an art form. It will be a strategy by people who understand the process we're involved in, the mixed media, corporate mixed media, I call it. Mixed corporate media. In other words, the media, the radio, television, satellite, computers, magazines, newspapers, they're all interacting. They're in a daily civil war, feeding off each other. When you understand that process, and I think James Joyce's Spinning His Wake was the beginning of a new strategy, Eliot said the discoveries of Joyce were like that of an Einstein, a man who made scientific breakthroughs that his followers could develop and explore with. So it's a tradition that you have to come to grips with and then make it relevant to your particular age, your time. That's the role of the artist. And the artist, therefore, would not identify with any particular trade, craft, medium, or skill. He would have an approach that draws attention to a process bigger than himself.
Is that manifest in a lifestyle?
No. It's manifested in a way of interacting with all the environments that we all have to deal with every day. In other words, our man becomes an organic art form. And the wisdom for that approach comes from the man or woman who understands that process.
Are we, as a civilized community, are we in better stead than we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Are we more civilized than we once were?
Well, civilizing is an action that particularly pertains to a centralized, organized law and order society that recognizes the rights of the individual. That came out of the literate tradition.
You know, I'm talking about something a little bit more sophisticated.
You mean balance? You mean
as individuals? I mean, this whole throughout the 60s, the emphasis was on your individuality, Ayn Rand and egoism and that sort of thing. And it just has not seemed to have come to anything.
Right, because any concept or any ideal or image of what we should be doesn't work anymore. And once that's understood, then you have to use concepts as precepts.
Why doesn't that work?
Because no individual can have a basis for power anymore or any kind of perspective. I mean, Warhol picked it up in the 50s with his 15 minutes, but that was a temporary, he was explaining the environment, the pop environment. But it's even more ravishing in all institutions. Even scientists can't even get their peace movement going because of the media swamp on all the different forms of expression today. These points of view, these causes get swamped. I don't think there's any possibility for individual idealistic causes. But there is an attempt, there is a possibility of getting perspective on the situation, which would create what you call a civilizing or a sort of super civilized subatomic man, because we're both inflated beyond all proportions of previous time. Each individual, like by us being on the air right now, we're inflated over Toronto, our voices.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have potentially 10 million people listening.
Yes.
So that's bigger than one individual body. At the same time, we're a tiny little voice in a process of 1,000 other radio and TV and media outlets. So we're both subatomic and super civilized.
My God. It's awful, isn't it, when you think about it in some ways.
We've unleashed incredible sources that I think that most of the media managers could be considered P.D. Barnums.
Yes.
You know, and Bronco hustlers and rodeo. We've just forces that are just ravaging whole populations that are not given a chance to get any respite from it.
Do you think that also might in part explain, and I don't mean to generalize these whole arguments, but it might in part explain a sort of a populist notion that the true self-actualized or the whole person is in fact schizophrenic or is psychologically a little diffused?
Especially the Western man. He's a literate tradition. He's trained in his industrial environment, and then he has to deal with an electric environment, which is totally opposite. So the Western world is very schizophrenic. But the Eastern world, the third worlds, are gradually jumping into the fray.
What's going to become of the traditional arts? The narrative mode, poetry, theater?
They will react to the situation, create styles, but they will just be temporary pulses on the corporate blip.
So, in fact, it's fighting, a losing battle?
Under these conditions, yeah. I think people should, if they want to preserve any of the old arts and crafts, they should demand the television be turned off for at least a week to show us how it affects us. Media fast.
Are they worth preserving?
Yes, because they give people, I think they will continue as pastimes, like basket weaving. But certainly they have no force, as witness the incredible economic problems that governments and corporations say they have. They have no respect for what the Canada Council and the Arts Community of Canada have built up over the last 20 years. That has to go by the way, because there are incredible larger forces that generally the population has to deal with. So little crafts and disciplines have no influence anymore.
Anyway, Robert Dean, I'm sorry, but we've come to the end of our time, and as usual, it's been interesting. I don't know where the resolve is, but maybe we've imparted a little bit more knowledge. I've certainly gained wisdom from speaking with you today.
And I have gained a few more questions talking to you.
Thank you, playwright Robert Dean. For Critical Culture, I'm Dennis Armstrong.